Hello, I'm Rory McKiernan, author of Hitching for Hope, and you're very welcome to the Love and Courage podcast. A heartfelt thanks to all you patrons who continue to chip in and support and promote the podcast in whatever way you can. My guest in this episode is Anne Rin. Anne is a singer, songwriter and community stalwart living in Milltown, Malbay, not too far away from me here in County Clare on the wild west coast of Ireland. Anne took up the guitar in her 60s and since then has created and released two albums. It might be no surprise that music was a calling for Anne given her family background. She grew up in County Kildare in the same household as two famous Irish folk musicians, Luca Bloom and Christy Moore. Anne is hugely respected in her community as being a real force for love and courage. This episode was originally created for my other podcast, The Creative Souls of Clare podcast, and it got a great response, so I thought I would share it here for you, Love and Courage podcast listeners, and I hope you enjoy it. It was recorded over Zoom during one of the lockdown periods, so the video version is also available if you look up Anne Rin, Creative Souls of Clare on Facebook or on YouTube. You can find the video there. I know you're going to enjoy the episode, so please do consider sharing it where you can, as well as subscribing if you're new to the Love and Courage podcast and leaving ratings, reviews, all that kind of thing on your favorite podcast app. It helps the podcast grow and get inspirational and wise voices like Anne's out into the world. Now let's get started with this conversation with Anne Rin. Anne Rin, how is life for you in Milltown, Malbay?
Just very, very good at the moment, Rory. We're all well, which is most important. We're all being as patient as we can be, and we're just getting on with it.
Good on you.
What more can we do?
Good on you. Well, thanks for joining me. It's great. I really think of you as somebody that's oozing creativity, you know, that... It's fair to say like you've definitely had a rich few years of it, and you know, two albums in how long? It's a short enough period.
I picked up the guitar 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. It's, I mean, to hear you saying that is kind of what? It's amazing. Yeah.
8 years ago. So you were what? 24.
I was 64.
64.
Yeah. Well, I'm 64.
Lovely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then from picking up the guitar to creating the first album, what was the time?
That was 60. I launched it in 2016, my first album, on my birthday, actually.
And was that like a lifelong dream, or what was the kind of impulse? Did it just take its own course and journey and unfold before you?
Yeah, it wasn't a life's dream. I always knew I could sing, but I come from a musical family, as you are aware. My mother and father were both fabulous singers, and there they are right behind me on my shoulder.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
And so obviously I am aware of your musical family, but not everyone maybe watching or listening would be. So maybe you might want to
I'd be absolutely delighted to. Behind me are my parents, Andy Moore and Nancy Power. And they're the ones that gave us all the beautiful gift of music. And my brothers have gone on to do queer things around music and become just a little known, like around the country. Christy Moore, you might have heard of him, being the eldest of the family. And then the other bookend is Barry, our darling brother Barry, who is also known as Luca Bloom. And my other family, my sisters, are Eilish and Terry, both good singers, and my brother down in Cork, Andy, is also a terrific singer.
Wow.
Yeah. And
it's time to get the band back together, I think. Yeah,
wouldn't it be cool? I mean, I'd love it, but I don't know at this stage now it'll ever happen. But nothing like dreaming.
If not in this world, maybe in the other world. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
And can you talk to me a little bit about your parents, Anne, and what influences they had on you, particularly musically?
Well, my father died when we were all very young. I mean, Christy was 11 and I was 8 and Barry was a year old. So we have he was only 41 when he died very tragically and very suddenly. And my memories of him would be very few, very few. One thing I do remember, I've actually got two very vivid memories of him. One is of him. He was a big man, big broad-shouldered man, walking up the town with his newspaper under his oxter, whistling. And I could hear him from the house. I could go, oh, Daddy's coming, Daddy's coming. And then going out to visit Granny Moore out in Milltown, he'd be singing, what was the song he sang? I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts. And I remember that. I was only maybe 5 or 6 at the time, you know. And that's really all the memories I have of him. But Nancy was an amazing singer, beautiful singer. She won medals all over the place. She won the Fish Kjol in, she won a gold medal in the Fish Kjol. I can't remember the year now, but back along, as they say. And she sang in all the musicals in Newbridge, and she's a beautiful, beautiful voice. She sang in the choir in the Dominican college, and she was an amazing woman, very strong woman to be left with 6 children so young. And she raised us all. She had to work very, very hard. And but there was always music in the house. Of a Saturday evening, like, she'd sit at the piano and neighbours would come in and we'd all be there and we'd be singing away. And she was a remarkable woman, remarkable. I actually have her here right beside me as well.
Oh, that's lovely.
That's one of the last photographs that was taken of her, with Mary Robinson.
Oh, just hold that up closer to the camera there, Anne, for those that are watching this.
Yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Photo of Nancy and Mary Robinson, former President of Ireland. That's amazing.
That was 2 months before she died. It was our last day out together. We were invited up to lunch at Áras an Uachtaráin by our president, our beloved president. And it was such, oh my God, I'm really crying thinking about it. It was such a beautiful, beautiful day.
Fantastic. And yeah. And so that music was in the air and in the house and in the bones, in a sense. But yeah. Where then did it go for you from there? Like, is that something that you took on throughout school and after school?
No, for starters, I hated school. Absolutely hated it. I got married very young. I met Dava Grin when I was 16, and I got married to him at 19, and we proceeded to have 5 children. And we lived in Prosperous in County Kildare, in Downing's house, where Christie's terrific album at the beginning of Planxty, the album was made in the basement in Downing's house. What a week that was, man. Oh, that was something else. There was some learning in that. Marvellous. It was a marvellous week. And then we decided, because Davok is also a musician, he plays the whistle, and we decided, through circumstances, to move from Kildare down to Clare. And that's 43 years ago on the 16th of December, next month. Never for one second did we regret it. We love it. Absolutely love living here.
So like, I'm kind of curious as well that, like, a lot of the... a lot of people I meet in County Clare aren't originally from County Clare, but... That's not necessarily ever emphasized. You know, it feels like a county that has strong roots and strong identity, but yet seems to be very welcoming and embracing yeah. of people yeah. from all over.
Very much so. I think when we moved here in 77, we might have been sort of the first of a bunch of people that began to move into Clare, and it was a little bit challenging. The first sort of 6 months. But the fact that we had 5 children made people realise they must be serious about what they're doing. They wouldn't be doing this if they weren't with 5 children, you know. And we integrated fairly quickly into the community, and we're just very blessed to live where we live.
And that integration, you know, it makes me think of... you know, the depth of community spirit in Clare, and I know that that's been a big part of your life. That,
oh yeah,
you could
yeah.
say, like, you know, community supporting each other, but also community activism or community actions being part of your life as well. Is,
oh gosh,
you think that's another influence of Nancy?
Definitely, both my parents actually, because Daddy was a politician. He was actually chair of Kildare County Council when he died. But that's going back again. But all our lives we have been taught. We were taught by our parents to be supportive of people and justice for people, and to make sure that things were done right. And I've always been very interested in the whole concept of community development. So much so that when our youngest left home and went to college, his old ma went to college as well. I went up to Maynooth and did a course in community development. And worked down in Kilkee and Kilrush down in South Clare for a number of years. And loved it, absolutely loved it. Yeah.
And what was that like, going to college at that time? Was that evenings, weekends? How did that work out?
Well, I actually went up and lived with my sister. My sister Terry lives in Newbridge, and I stayed with her, and I managed to organise a lift out to Maynooth from another student every day, and we got on really well, and that worked very well. So I'd go up on a Monday morning and come home at the weekends then to look after Davok and Donica and get back up there again. Rory, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was just like going into a different world. It was fabulous. Such an honour to be able to do it. Yeah.
And what about then, what came next in Kilkee? And talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I did my final exam on a Friday, and I did an interview on Monday for a job in Kilkee with Éirigh Corcabosheen, and I got the job. And I was blown away, completely blown away. I mean, I had spent 26 years at home looking after the family, and this was such a whole new thing for me. After 2 years in Maynooth, and then to walk into a job like that, it was fantastic, and I loved it. I did a lot of work around women, setting up women's groups in the area. I worked with around childcare. We organised. I actually did another course down in Cork around the social economy. Did a diploma around that, and we came back to South Clare and set up early childcare, early years. I can't remember the name of it now; it's so long ago. But anyway, work like that, and working with people with disabilities, I'd have a fair idea of the way of disability in Ireland, because one of our boys is a disabled man, he's been a fighter. His name is Donica Rin. He turned 50 in June. Oh my God. I mean, that's just amazing to me. And he has fought all his life for his rights and for the rights of people with disabilities. He was one of the founders of the Disabled People of Clare, and worked with Dermot. I'm sure you know the comrade, Dermot Hayes, and worked with, I don't know where I'm going with this now, but he's a remark. He's actually the inspiration of our lives, Donica, if you don't mind me talking about him for a few.
Not at all. In fact, yeah. You know, this podcast is Creative Souls of Clare, and he is a creative soul of Clare, isn't he?
He sure is. I just tell you a little bit about him. Donica, when he was born, he was a twin. He was the second twin. His twin is Niall. And Donica suffered very mild brain damage at birth. So he had a very mild form of cerebral palsy. And all his young life, he wanted to just be a normal guy. He wanted to be like Niall. And he really fought hard. I kind of think he fought too hard. He, when he was 19, he started to fall. And for 5 years, they couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And eventually, the diagnosis came in that he had MS, multiple sclerosis. And ever since then, he has struggled with his life. He has struggled since then. He's had a very difficult life, and currently, that he is still alive is remarkable. We have the most amazing team of people who look after him. Our local GP, Dr. Billy, is they're just the dream team, I call them. And Donica is in there inspiring us all. He doesn't communicate a lot these days. He's very fragile, very, very vulnerable. And, but he's still there. He's still smiling. And, ask him, how are you today? And I'm going, grand, ma, how are you? Yeah, he's the mystical man. That's what he is, our Duns.
Can you talk to me about Donica's book?
I sure can. So Barry, my brother Barry, every time we went in to visit Donica, he'd come out and he'd say, that fella has a book in him. How are we going to do it? Because at this stage, Donica couldn't write anymore because of the MS. And so we decided, we had a big long chat about it, and we asked a great friend of Donica's, Tom Prendergast, would he be interested in coming into Donica maybe once a week with a recorder and recording him. And Tom jumped at it. He absolutely loved the idea because he loves Donegal. And for 2 years, once a week, Tom came into Donegal. And I'd say it was a very difficult job because Donegal's memory was beginning to go. And but Tom stuck with it. And the result of that that project was Being Donegal, Donegal's book. And the front of the book is Being Donegal. It's Donegal's words recorded. And then the middle of the book is Donegal's poetry, which he wrote when he was a teenager. And at the back of the book, then it's Knowing Donegal. So the family all chipped in and wrote words about him and stuff. And it's an absolutely delightful book. It's 10 years out now, and it's still as fresh as a daisy. It still resonates with people because Donegal, it's Donegal's truth. That's what I call it. It's Donegal's truth. He's just a really special guy. Very, what I say about Donegal is he was born old. You know, that kind of a person.
Yeah.
An old wise head on him, and a great sense of what life is about. I have never, in the 50 years I know this man since he was born, I have never heard him complaining. I have never heard him saying, why me, or being angry, or just giving out about why he got this life. Never. He's very, very grateful for the life he has. He's remarkable. And, you know, even though people don't see him, his spirit is all over the place. He's around. So people can feel Donegal in town. People locally here would always ask, how is he? How's he doing? Isn't he amazing? And they're aware of him. And some, those who believe pray for him. And it's just lovely. It's lovely, the impression he has had on our world.
It just occurs to me now that the beautiful tribute you've been paying to him there, that, you know, he's now going to be heard about from people all over Clare, but all over Ireland, and in fact all over the world, you know. So
his
spirit is rippling out there.
Fantastic. I'm so precious. I could talk about him all day.
Well, listen, before we move back on to you, Anne, we might as well talk about the other fella as well that in your household that probably my sense is that he'd be a little bit shy himself of talking about, you know, but
the Dav man.
Yeah, but you are a creative powerhouse, and you're, you know, as individually but collectively. But could you just tell people a little bit about your wonderful husband as well?
Davok is his name, and Davok is now 81, and he's retired. He was all of his life. Davok was always fascinated with old furniture. And when I met him, he was a farmer with one cow, and he always had the excuse, I have to go home and milk the cow. But anyway, he got really into the antiques. He started going to auctions. This is way back in the 60s now. And he became quite a successful antiques dealer, and he specialized in country furniture, country folklore, folk life, that kind of thing. And he loved it. He really loved it, and he's quite an expert on it. He would know the different styles from the different parts of the country. Like, the dressers made in Cork are totally different to dressers made in Donegal, that kind of thing.
Amazing.
So he worked at that all of his life, but alongside that, he played the whistle. Now, for about 10 or 15 years, when we were busy rearing the family, there was no music going on in the house. But then he started playing again, and He has become quite a whistle player, fabulous whistle player. So when he started to retire, he decided he'd have to do something about the whistle playing. So what does he do? He gets a permit to go up and busk up at the Cliffs of Moher. And I swear to God, it's been the making of him. He loves it. He absolutely loves it. And he goes up. Well, he's not doing it at the moment, obviously. But he really loves it. He loves seeing the people coming in and dancing around him and having the crack. And he's a lovely, lovely whistle player. He loves nothing more than to go and join Owen O'Neill at his sessions and play with Owen. And Clare and the traditional music of Rory, just remarkable. We desperately miss the sessions, but we'll get back to it.
Yeah, and you're living in, you know, quite the national hotspot in Milltown for Willie Clancy.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
All the surrounding.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, so that's been obviously a large part of your life as well. Just that.
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, the Willie Clancy Summer School has been a lifesaver for Milltown Malbay, thanks to the wonderful Willie Clancy. What a marvellous man he was. I actually used to run a thing called the People's Kitchen for about 12 years. I did it during the summer school, and I absolutely loved it. It was the best of fun. Like, we'd be making 500 meals a day, the hardest work I ever did. Oh my God. But it was all vegetarian before it was cool to be a vegetarian, and all vegetarian, all freshly prepared. And I used to hate the thought of it. I'd start preparing for it around May, March. And by the time it came around in July, once the first cup of tea was made, I was off. And the buzz for 10 days was just huge. I loved it. It was great.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
It was. It really was.
And,
yeah.
And just before we finish up talking about Davog, can you tell people a little bit about his book as well?
Oh, God, you're a great man to remember things. So for alongside playing the whistle and... the antique dealing and that. All his life, Davok has written down things anywhere and everywhere. And I kept saying to him, I've been reading his notes and his stories, and I said, Dav, you really should work on getting that together. So himself and myself and a dear friend of ours, Trish Flanagan, got it together. And he published the book a year ago. Is it a year ago now or 2 years ago? No, I think it was last year, October last year, we published it alongside my second album. It's called Strike a Light, and it's just a book of stories and some fiction and some about family, some memories. And he has a lovely, he's a kind of a unique way of writing. He's, because when you read Davok's stories, you can actually hear his voice in them, and it's just lovely. I'd be slightly biased, but...
Is there any chance of knocking an audio book out of him?
There's a thought.
There's something we'll talk about that again, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So let's go back to your music, Anne. And yeah. You know, what was that journey like picking up the guitar, and where did it start, and how did it start?
Okay, so Barry, my brother, my fabulous brother Barry, moved to Clare about 9 years ago now. And he lives up in Liscannor. And one day he was down. We were sitting around the table drinking a cup of tea. He said, Anne, why are you not singing? And I spoke very... I used to always get flustered if I thought somebody was going to ask me to sing. I was a bit of a nervous Nelly Rory, which is ridiculous. So I said that to him. I said, Barry, I get very nervous if people ask me to sing. And he says, you know, when you're singing a song, Anne, you're delivering a message. And all you got to do is just remove yourself from it and just deliver the message. And it was kind of like, what? Why did I never think of that? Mm. Never occurred to me. So that kind of started it. And then my son in Davog, who lives in France, who is also a musician and an artist, sent me a message one day. He says, Man, learn a few songs and come on over and sing at this festival with me. And I said, what? Okay. So I did. And then about a month after Barry and I had that conversation, he came into the house one day carrying a guitar, and he handed it to me. And these are the exact words. He says, I am not giving you this guitar. I'm loaning it to you for 50 years on condition that you play it every day. He didn't have to say it twice. Oh, my God. I just grasped it with both hands. But I love it. I absolutely love it. It was very, the first year was tough now, learning it, my poor fingers, but I just love it. I took to it like a duck to water. And then one day he said to me, come on up and sing a few songs that you've learned and we'll have a listen. And then he said to me, I think you could record some of those songs. And I said, what? Are you mad? Wow. So we did. So, and.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Here she is.
So that's the first album you're showing me there. Fantastic.
The first album, yeah. And it's an album of covers. At the time, I wasn't writing any songs. And just amazing. What a buzz. Lordy gordy.
And were you aware that was like an active kind of mentoring? It certainly sounds like mentoring.
Oh, I would consider Barry my mentor completely, yeah, definitely. Well, what he said to me, he said, I always knew you could sing, and I always knew you were a really good singer, and I always knew that you could do harmonies, and you're just full of music, and I just wondered why you never did anything with it. So he gave me the, he just gave me the little push that I needed.
Yeah, it's a great question for anyone, isn't it? You know, why did you not do anything with that thing that you have? And I suppose
Sorry for cutting across you. People would say to me, you must have been dreaming about this all your life.
Yeah.
I was too busy to be thinking about things like that, you know.
But yeah.
I'm grateful at this stage in my life to have it.
But does that speak to the idea that you were, you know, it's not you exclusively, this is people, but I would say perhaps also disproportionately women of a generation as well that maybe didn't have the luxury of having those dreams?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or didn't have the time to even stand still to have a dream.
To even think about having a dream.
Yeah.
Because I suppose if you work, as I did for 26 years, you kind of, you as a person, kind of, you disappear, you melt into the family and you kind of disappear. I disappeared for 26 years. And I don't mean that in any derogatory way of you with regards to my family. That was just what happened. And there was a lot of learning in it. But we learn every day. We learn every day. And just my life in the last 8 years has just been remarkable.
Mm.
Never imagined it for a sec. I mean, I did the Late Late Show. Rory. I nearly died of fright, mind you. But
so that's obviously the biggest TV show in Ireland. And what was that like, you know, just the days up running up to that and what was going through your mind?
It was absolutely terrifying. I was, but the reason I was doing it was because I'd written a song about homeless children. And I just decided that I am doing this. I am absolutely doing this. Because in all of the talk around the homeless crisis that's on in Ireland still, all the talk of the 3,000 or 4,000 children, God between us and all harm, when I think of it, that are homeless, you never heard a child's voice. And I just wanted to remind people about that. So I wrote a song called Mammy, When Are We Going Home? And the Late Late Show asked me, would I come up and sing it on the show? And I said, this is not about me. It's not about entertainment. It's not about Ryan Tuberty or anything else. This is about homeless children. And I kept my focus on that. That got me through it.
Yeah, it delivered a message.
Yeah, exactly. Delivered a message, yeah.
Yeah, and that reminds me of the power of music as a form of, I suppose you could say, agitation, mobilization, you know, absolutely, campaigning. Like folk music in particular has traditionally had that important role.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. In fact, I tell you a little story. The day I launched my album at the Doolin Folk Festival, my first album at the Doolin Folk Festival, Bernadette Devlin was in the audience. And you would be familiar with Bernadette Devlin, I'm sure, Bernadette McCallisky.
I would, but just for anyone that isn't, maybe just give a very quick reference to...
Bernadette was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement in the North in the late 60s, early 70s, and complete and absolute shero of mine, a heroine of mine. I just, marvellous, marvellous woman. And Barry said to me before I went out on stage, he says, you know, Bernadette Devlin's in the audience. I said, oh my God. afterwards I was talking to people about her. I said, oh my God, I was just so thrilled to meet her. And some people said to me, said, who's she? And I was horrified. I was just so horrified.
Yeah.
So one of the first songs I ever wrote was called Bernadette.
Yeah.
Bernadette Devlin.
And even the fact that, you know, she's such a seminal figure in modern Irish history and politics and culture. The fact that a huge amount of people wouldn't know of her is intentional, you know, maybe not as an individual level, but systemically, that the system has, in a sense, tried to erase radical voices like that.
Sure, Bernadette Devlin would have been a nightmare for the system and is still fighting away, fair play to her.
Yeah,
fair play to her,
yeah. And hence the power of music again to remind people and keep memory alive.
Yeah. I'm very drawn towards songs like that, like Patti Smith's song, Power to the People. No, I always say that wrong. It's people have the power.
Oh, yeah.
People Have the Power. I love that song. And there was a song that Johnny Cash wrote, which is on my second album, called What Is Truth? And it's a song he sang to Richard Nixon in 1974. And I came across it and I thought, oh my God, is that ever relevant today, in today's world? So, some great songs, some marvelous songs out there. And I've written a song about Greta Thunberg, which I really like, and I love the work that she's doing. And my ear would be very open for songs around life in today.
And you've also written I can't remember the exact words or name of the song, but I once heard you singing a song about the locality and the community and kind of the butcher, the baker type song.
What's
that one?
Oh,
you sang it at My Hill Farm.
I did.
It was about the joy of, you know, going in and picking up the bread from the baker and then going off and having the chat. And you have so many songs now.
I wrote my first song about 3 days after I launched my first album.
Oh, fantastic.
And I've been writing ever since, and it's just lush.
And what does your creative practice look like in terms of where do you shut yourself away in a room or where does it happen? And is it any time of the day or?
Yeah, any time of the day or night. Sometimes I wouldn't be a great sleeper and sometimes I'd be awake and things would be going through my head. So normally what I would do is I take up the pen and I just start just writing whatever's in my mind. And then before I know it, there's a line going there, and it could be like that. And some songs come out just like that. The mammy song came out just like that. I think if I feel something really deeply, it'll come out fast. Some of them you struggle with. If I put away a few songs that I might get back to or I might not.
Yeah.
But some of them are easy. There was one that I wrote recently called Be Kind. I'm a divil about the kindness, about love and kindness. And I think we all need to be to show love and to be kind more every day.
That strikes me as almost almost Buddhist in approach, loving kindness.
Yeah, I would have really latched onto that. I wouldn't consider myself. I'm not a religious person, but I am. I suppose we all have a spirit. We all have a spirit, and I think, and I used to go down to Dochambeira in West Cork for, they have had a retreat called Loving Kindness Retreat. I did that for about 3 years and really benefited from it. And that's where I learned a lot about how positive and how good love is and kindness is and how we need to be more vocal about it. Why are people so shy about being kind and showing love for people? You know, it's so important. But be kind. Yeah,
here's to that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Easiest thing in the world to do, Rory. If you're, say you've somebody in your head and you're giving out in your head about it, all you've got to use is those two words, be kind. It turns it around completely, immediately. Yeah. And changes your mood. It's amazing.
And I would also say that in that, the importance of being kind to yourself, isn't it?
Definitely.
You know, that's one of the harder ones.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
When you're done flogging yourself.
Practice what you preach.
Put away the whip from the flogging or whatever, you know.
I know.
Yeah. It's a big one. So, and are you working on any projects these days or anything brewing and stirring?
Not really at the moment. I have great women. I'm very involved with the Clare Women's Network, and I was chair of it for a few years, and we're working on racism at the moment, and I'm finding that very, very interesting, and I'm learning an awful lot about it.
What are you learning about it?
That the privilege that we as white people have, and it's shocking. It really is shocking. And that we need to learn. It's in our DNA, you see, because Ireland has been such a white country, but that is now changing, and we need to learn how to integrate all the colours of the world into Ireland, and to treat people. As far as I'm concerned, I see people as human beings. I honestly don't see colour. The first day we started talking about this, I was so shocked that I was silent, because I did not know how to respond. And they talk about white privilege and white this and white that. I have never in my 72 years had to consider that I am white. I've never had to think about it even. You know, it's very strange. It's very strange, and it must be very strange for all of our new citizens coming into the country. It must be very difficult for them. Very, very difficult for them. And we need to skill ourselves to help them to integrate into our world.
And what do you think it is that creates the pushback on that? Because, you know, there will be some people who will say, well, why do I have to change? It's my country and it's my place and it's my this and that.
Systemic. It's the system. The system is all wrong, Rory. The system is all wrong. The system is not about people. The system is about profit, patriarchy, money, finance, business. Oh, it drives me mad. The system drives me mad.
There's a line for the song anyway. Yeah. So we won't get into it too much here, Anne, because it's a whole nother...
You'd need a whole day to talk about it.
Well, I was going to talk specifically about the direct provision and stuff, but I just when you are talking about some of this integration and so on, you know, I remember fellas from different parts of the world and a lot of Muslim guys that, you know, in the last few years, there's been a lot of demonization or images painted of what a Muslim guy is and looks like and sounds like. And then when I came to meet some of them in Milltown Malby in an emergency direct provision center, there was such a gentle kindness and timidness. It was unusual. It was kind of very striking. And then to see them very kind of isolated and lonely, and it can be very romantic being in the west of Ireland when you know everyone and all the rest. But if you don't know a soul, it can be bleak and miserable.
Awful.
But you were given lifts to the lads to the beach to bring them swimming, and that was such a you could say a simple act, but a powerful act.
To me, it just felt like the obvious thing to do. Here's they don't know the area, they don't know what's going on, and I just offered them a lift. And then when I said it, I started saying, oh my God, oh Janie, what am I after doing? And I just did it anyway. And it was one of the best things I did for a long time. It was just amazing to see the joy on their faces diving into the sea. Some of these people had never, ever seen the sea before. They'd never been at the seaside. And to be out in Spanish Point diving into the waves was just... Oh, it was just fabulous, you know. And it was just amazing to meet those young men, and some of them had been through so much. Oh my God, it was a very difficult time for them. It was a wonderful time because the community really gathered around them, and we helped them, and we got them playing guitars, and we got them singing and dancing. We organized dancing classes for them and English classes. And it kind of, you know yourself, the direct provision system is such a corrupt is not even the right word to use. It's just wrong. It's done the wrong way. And the length of time that they have to spend in direct provision is just crazy. It's the system. The system is so wrong.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't end very well at Milltown. It didn't end very well at all in Milltown Malby. The place was closed down for a finish, and rightly so, because it wasn't fit for purpose.
Yeah. Well, it was only meant to be a temporary centre anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm staying with direct vision, but moving more into the role of creativity and the arts there, because one of the things that I observed in that community work around that and elsewhere was dance, drumming, guitar, singing, seeing lads from Libya or Iraq or wherever, you know, just, you know, playing the oud or and then other lads with Irish music. And then you had Brian Fleming playing who's a prolific West African drummer from Ireland, teaching African drumming to the Africans.
Amazing.
But there's such a bonding through music and dance that transcends all of the shite and the politics.
It's universal. Music is universal, you know. You mightn't understand the words of a song and you might be deeply moved by it and you don't know why you're deeply moved by it. It's fantastic.
And then I remember hearing an Iraqi song and a kind of lament, you know, and thinking such Shan Nos sensibility to it.
It's universal, you see. It's completely universal. And I can't get over the healing qualities of music. I can't get over how calming it can. It makes you calm. It makes you feel happy. If I feel down, or if I'm lacking in energy, I'll go and I'll pick up the guitar and I'll sing a few songs, and that's that gone. Beautiful. It's really beautiful, and it should be. It should be. The way musicians and artists are being treated during the current scenario, chaos, is beyond disgraceful. Beyond disgraceful, you know, and that will have to be looked at. That will definitely have to be looked at, because music and arts and culture have to be much more to the front than culture is at the moment. It's people are really struggling.
There's certainly like a lot of people talking about the need for music and culture and arts, but then to It needs infrastructure and resources and support and radio play and all of these things, not just kind words, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I know in France, for example, because Davog, my son, lives there, and they have a system in France where if you are a musician or if you are an artist, and it's like you're self-employed and you're not working all the time because the gigs aren't on all the time. If you do for example, with him, if he does a certain number of gigs every year, he's entitled to a benefit, an artist's benefit, which he gets. And that keeps the bread on the table and the bills paid.
Yeah. Well, I know myself, just to have the benefit of, you know, and I don't always have it, but the consistency of bread on the table can free up a lot of creativity as well.
Sure. Yeah.
Now, they do also say hunger is a good sauce, but that's probably overly egged on and romanticized that, you know. It's a big thing, livelihoods. And I think that's, you know, it's just important that artists are respected and valued, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, Anne, just before we finish up, I just want to get your thoughts on anyone that hasn't really perhaps tapped their full creativity or maybe has an inkling, or, you know, maybe doesn't even consider themselves as a so-called creative person. Yeah. Would you have any thoughts on that?
I would have loads of thoughts on that.
Good.
I very little to say about it, except if you have ever had an inclination or a goo on you, or I wonder would I be able to do that? Just go and do it. Just go and do it. It's amazing. It is beyond amazing how it will change your life. And just trust yourself and just go and do it. I mean, as I said earlier, I was 68 when I released my first album. And wow, amazing. I love it. And I have never been healthier and I have never been happier. With all due respect to my family, I love them all dearly. But as for me, I have never been happier. I'm much lighter in myself. I'm just happy, very happy, a very happy person. And that's because of my music and my creativity and writing. And just open up your heart and open up your mind, and you'd never know what will happen.
Well said, Anne. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and long may you prosper and create. And thanks for your time and kind words and great stories, and look forward to seeing you playing some music before
long. Likewise, and lots of love to you and Susie. Thanks a million, Rory. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Thank you. Hello, Ruairí here again. A huge thanks to Anne for that great conversation and to you for listening. Please help others find this episode by sending them a link, by mentioning it on social media, by subscribing to the podcast and by leaving a rating and a review on your favorite podcast app. And if you do feel inclined, you can chip in to the podcast as a patron or donor over at loveandcourage.org. It all matters. It's all appreciated. It helps get voices like Anne's out into the world. If you are new to the podcast, do check out the archive. Some wonderful conversations in there. Thanks again to all of you who are part of the Love and Courage community. I look forward to sharing more episodes with you soon. Thanks again.